We're just about ready to get started, and the purpose of this is to be an informal discussion. No written questions, just mics to be passed around. And so, George, are we going to start recording at some point? Do you all mind if this is recorded? Okay. So, but again, very informal, no formal Commonwealth Club process. I just thought it would be good to be able to talk about what happened in Tucson a couple of weeks ago. And I think we were all struck by that tragedy, where 20 people were shot and several killed by a mentally disturbed individual. And there was a young girl, the congresswoman. We've all been following her recovery. One of her aides was killed, as you know, the chief judge in the state of Arizona. And so I thought it would be interesting to talk about what the issues are there. A lot of the national discussion has centered around the lack of civility and political rhetoric and so on. But then, of course, there's the issue of access to guns. There's the issue of mental illness. It's lack of recognition and the combination of mental illness and access to guns, which to me seems to have been one of the major factors here. So we're going to talk about all of those issues tonight. Is there one mic, two mics? You just raise your hand or indicate and we'll get one of the mics to you. I have a lapel mic so I can use that. And George Dobbins, our program director, Camille Cui, who's a program staffer, have the two mics, and they'll be happy to hand one over to you. Oh, you don't have it. You have it. Ron? Ron is a volunteer at the Commonwealth Club. Tonight, we'll talk about those issues, and I'd also like to point out that we have a group of, I think, what, sixth and eighth graders with us? And would you tell us, I understand you're from something called the League of Creative Minds. What is the League of Creative Minds?
So the League of Creative Minds, we're a debate group, and it represents several schools throughout the Bay Area. And it's, what, sixth through seniors? And we go across the nation, sometimes internationally, to different Model United Nations conferences to discuss different world issues.
Thank you. We're really happy that you're here. I also recognize Jackie Jacobberger, the immediate past president of the League of Women Voters of California. And I'm sure there are others here whom I know. So why don't we start out just by, I'll lead the discussion, and I've also brought some factual information that I will throw into the discussion now and then if it's useful and helpful about incidents of mental illness, gun ownership, new proposals for gun control, the discussion about political civility that's been going on and so on. So I will just add some information that might help to expand the discussion, but really this is for you to talk about what you'd like to talk about. And I thought it might be interesting to just start out talking about this issue of political rhetoric and civility, the aggressive verbiage that we've seen in political debate, really to just see if any of you think that that is a major issue in what happened in Tucson. There's obviously, that was the first level of the discussion nationally. There was, of course, the discussion about Sarah Palin having imagery about this congressional district being in the crosshairs and then the blood libel charges and all of that. So I just thought it might be interesting to first focus on that question. And there's talk, of course, about the State of the Union address tomorrow night sounding a note of conciliation between the political left and right and so on. Does anyone think that the lack of political civility and the sharp rhetoric and some of the imagery that we've seen had a major impact on what happened in Tucson? I see Fred Martin shaking his head. Ron, Mike, to Fred.
Well, I suspect that the rhetoric it did nothing to improve the climate. I had a second cousin who was hanging out in Tucson, a former psychiatric nurse who encountered severe psychiatric problems, the same problems that this shooter had. Fortunately, sadly, I mean, he turned to pot and went without treatment. And fortunately and sadly, he turned the gun on himself instead of somebody else. But I think that when somebody is paranoid schizophrenic, which seems to be the diagnosis down there, that their delusions are somewhat affected by their environment, but a lot of them, as we know, come from within. And somehow he, if the what we hear, and I thought the Chronicle did a superb job in that first day story about the mental illness. The paranoid schizophrenic, and the Cho in, at West Virginia, same thing.
That's Fred's reminding us the diagnosis of the young man. Was it Virginia Tech?
Yeah.
Where the 36 people were shot, 32 people were shot.
36 people,
had
yeah.
the same diagnosis as Mr. Luffner.
Yeah.
Paranoid schizophrenic.
And then there are others.
And the same gun, by the way. Same Pardon? Model of gun, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. It's sad that they get guns, but it's also difficult to have a list that protects the privacy of the people, because some people who actually take their medication and normalize their life, if they're on a list, it can affect their ability to get a job.
So you're saying you don't think that the political rhetoric
I don't think the political rhetoric did it. I think that he was triggered. I think that the political record could have created part of the environment, but I think also the whole Arizona climate of freedom to carry a gun and this laissez-faire attitude toward guns, so that there's no real barriers. But the fundamental problem that I see, and I was disappointed in what Chancellor Bergenau put out from Berkeley, because it could happen in Berkeley, because he didn't recognize the mental illness concept or aspect of this, and I emailed him accordingly. But
Fred is based at Berkeley these days at UC.
Yeah, the fundamental problem is that we're not really providing treatment that can stabilize people.
Okay,
like that.
Well, let's not get too far into the mental illness. Let's focus for a moment still on this question of political rhetoric. Okay, yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Peter Dumont, and I also represent a nonprofit organization, the Star Alliance, Foundation for All. But I want to respectfully counter a little bit. I think that the mentally ill are very sensitive to the social environment. In fact, they may be a very valuable window on the collective unconscious.
That's interesting.
That is pushing up just like an oil well and putting a lot of pressure, you know, or expressing a lot of pressure, and the mentally ill have fewer boundaries to keep it down.
Interesting thought.
So I think we should really respect them as a group and not underestimate them, and also provide them an environment of goodwill and respect and education.
So your point is that in a way we have to think about what the impact of the social climate is on those who are most sensitive to it.
And I don't think that our society, either domestically or globally, can afford to keep leaving people out and thinking that it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Especially in the nuclear age.
Thank you. Other thoughts, yes, ma'am, on the civility issue?
Thank you. My name's Carla Winter, and I'm a new member. It's my first night here.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
I haven't heard that the shooter we haven't heard the dialogue of what his political point of view is yet. And so I feel that it's been really merely conjecture at this point as to whether he was affected or not. And if he has actually disclosed his viewpoints, it's been masked to the public. So I think that remains to be seen. However, and I know my own gut reaction after The incident was immediately, I jumped on the, you know, the rhetoric that's been going on, and as well as Ms. Palin's graphic imagery. And the fact that so many of us reacted that way says it's really an active energy in our environment.
And so maybe what we're saying is, since we jumped to that conclusion, that's what's bothering a lot of the rest of us, even if there's no literal connection to what this guy did in Arizona. I think there was someone else. Yes.
So my name is Connor Warner. I'm also with the League of Creative Minds, and this is my first time at the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome.
So there was a study done recently. I believe it was the University of Berkeley. Well, basically, they studied people who have attempted a political assassination or have carried out their assassination and actually killed the person in question. And the conclusion that they reached was that the assassin in question made up their mind to kill someone before they decided to kill that person for political reasons. So they found the justification for their killing after the actual event. So I don't think it's the political rhetoric that caused the shooting. It's the political rhetoric. Sorry, let me back up. It's the political rhetoric doesn't need to change. It's that we need some sort of change in our mental health system, such as a list of mentally unstable individuals and to prevent them from purchasing a weapon. Although the question is, how do we protect ourselves and public individuals without invading the right to privacy of mentally unhealthy individuals?
Right. And so we'll get further into that. Just a few pieces of information here. In terms of detecting mentally unstable individuals, such as those with paranoid schizophrenia, the point at which this guy was 22 years old, the point at which schizophrenia usually manifests clearly is about that age. In fact, there's a young man I know who was a student at Harvard and was doing great until he was about 20 years old, and then his schizophrenia manifested. So how do you catch people that early in life when many of these illnesses don't become manifested until around that time? There wouldn't be much of a history or track record. And in his case, he had recently started saying strange things and behaving strangely in the classroom. So that's just a question back at you. How do you find those people and document the presence of mental illness at that young an age? And the same with the guy at Virginia Tech, who was quite young. Another aspect of this is that, I thought there was an interesting statistic, which I'll just throw out. How many people suffer from mental illness in the U.S.? About 4 million. How many guns are in private hands in the U.S.? Over 200 million. So the likelihood that those who are mentally ill will have access to guns under the current system is pretty high, in that there's more than one gun in, you know, in private ownership for every adult in the United States. So I just thought that was an interesting statistic. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the political rhetoric thing. Personally, I thought it was very forced and a little bit silly that we were trying to attribute his actions in any way to the level of political rhetoric, because I think there's really no evidence or no way that you can make that connection. It kind of reminded me, I think it was with Columbine, when they're trying to attribute the type of music they listened to or the video games they were playing as contributing to and causing them to do that. I think that's the same kind of connection that you really can't make. And I think it reflects poorly on the people who try to make that connection. But that being said, I think one of the reasons where it's become a kind of a hot topic is the level of political rhetoric is so high and so aggravated and so confrontational that it's causing the political system to stagnate, I think. I mean, it's, in other words, it's, we knew we should be concerned about the level of political rhetoric, not because of its effect on the mentally ill, but its effect on everyone else, and that our governmental processes are not working. How do you come up with a bipartisan solution when the other side is your enemy and evil, and you don't, you know, who wants to work in conjunction with the evil side and come up with a you know solution that you both agree on? No one.
Right.
And people are being divided that way. So that's why it's important, and that it should be a topic. But I wouldn't connect it to these acts of violence. And it seems to me that random acts of violence have been going on for decades and decades of this sort, whether it's Columbine or Virginia Tech or guy and going taking a shooting up McDonald's, which I remember quite a few years ago. I mean, these incidents here in they went over to a law firm on California Street,
right,
or maybe a decade ago.
Right.
I mean, these things are happening, and we act shocked when they happen again after you know a few years of it not happening. But it's been constant, and I don't think you can say the political rhetoric has changed now, but it wasn't maybe as heightened back then. So there's something. There's something else that we need to deal with, and I think, I'm sure we'll get to it, but gun control, I think, has got to be the major topic that we end
sure.
up talking about, and it's, I find it funny that, at least in the media, so much emphasis is on the rhetoric, and the gun control thoughts are mentioned here and there, and maybe we'll do it, but it's really not going to happen, so we shouldn't even maybe talk about it, but that's the aspect of this that I hope really gets some light shined on it.
So we'll get back to that question of it's a difficult nut to crack in this country to really do something about guns. And it's interesting, I brought a chart with me that some of you may have seen in the New York Times, which I'll pass around if you're interested. It is correlating the number of homicides in a country with the average number of firearms per 100 people, and then the percentage of homicides in relation to that number of firearms. And it has these balls here. It was, I think, about a little over a week ago in the New York Times Sunday edition. And the biggest ball, of course, with the highest incidence of handguns and the highest incidence of fatalities is the United States. And then you go down here to Slovenia, and Mexico is the next biggest, with, of course, a lot of the guns coming from the U.S. into Mexico. And then other countries after that. So I'll pass that around. It's kind of an interesting graphic presentation correlating the number of guns with the number of homicides.
I'd just like to sort of support the point that you had made. I recently read an article addressing a video game that came out that depicted a post-apocalyptic Washington, D.C. And the article was talking about how a lot of people in government were saying that these video games with these violent depictions could have a very negative effect on society, and they might give people the idea of doing these sort of things. But I think it's interesting that people make such a big jump from fantasy to reality. These video games are pretty not realistic. And I think it's just sort of people trying to dodge a really big bullet, and that's the real issue that needs to be discussed, which I think is definitely weapons control and all of these other big issues like mental illness and whatnot.
Yes, sir?
Well, on the subject of political rhetoric, if you look at U.S. history in particular, political rhetoric has been extreme from the very beginning. So I don't think that has any bearing whatsoever on has happened. I mean, the political rhetoric, it's a big topic of discussion today. In the beginning of the country, people burned each other's houses over
right.
political
and had,
problems.
And had
so.
Fist fights on the floor of Congress. So, yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Pascal Muse. I'm a resident in San Francisco, and I grew up in Texas as well as California, so I've seen sort of both ends of the gun debate. I wanted to first, when you mentioned the video games, echo what the young gentleman said, that we've had other video games that were about the U.S. Army leading gunfights through the streets of current-day Washington, D.C., that didn't raise any of that sort of furor. But the one that was imitating 1950s-era propaganda and making fun of it all, that one gets the massive amount of upset. So as long as the military is shooting in D.C., that's fine.
Right.
But beyond that, that the issue of gun control, when we get to it, has built up so much vitriol in terms of the relationship various people in the United States desire with both the federal and state governments that we have not come to any sort of conclusion regarding the, quote, the proper role of government and everything. But because there is such an antipathy to government that people believe that they need means of force against the, you know, old European model where the government has a monopoly on force through the police and such, but also that they believe that the force with a personal firearm, or at least the way it's been politicized, is sufficient to resist a government that would have a military at its disposal or otherwise, suggests that our discourse on how political and social interaction is meant to be, that there needs to be some sort of mutually assured dysfunction, has become unhealthy enough that this may be a much deeper cause. And that's not a constructive point, but it is something that suggests quickly assigning blame, as we're so wont to do in the current 24-hour news cycle, isn't going to give us useful answers.
You raise a, by the way, I love your name, Pascal Muse. That's a wonderful name. But you raise an interesting question about whether the argument that bearing individual firearms would really protect individuals against oppression from a government. So a few years ago, I went with the Pentagon. I'm a former Pentagon official. And they took a number of us to sites where the U.S. military is doing various things today, fighting terrorism, doing peacekeeping, etc. And one of the places we went was Bosnia. And a lot of what they showed us there was once the Balkan, you know, wars were over, the U.S. and other forces came in and essentially disarmed the population, which in this case was a good thing because they were shooting each other and, you know, there were a lot of improvised explosive devices coming in and so on. They actually took us into big tents and showed us all the weapons that they had collected from the population there. So a major military force, you know, that a government has, that has very sophisticated weapons and techniques, easily takes away the weaponry. In that case, appropriately. In this case, if it ever came, you know, to be the U.S. citizenry against the military of the United States, I'm not sure that, you know, handguns and hunting rifles would have much of an impact. So that's the first time that I've ever really thought about, you know, questioning that argument, that the citizen militia, the right to bear arms and so on, probably in this day and age with, you know, night vision goggles and laser-guided weapons and so on, is probably not an effective method of resistance because in so many cases, civilian populations have been disarmed fairly easily. Sure, but, all right, let's see.
The mic, sir.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to address the issue raised by the young man in blue over there. While most of the population and can separate fantasy and reality, one of the signs of mental illness is the inability to separate the two. So I agree with you that video games are a convenient boogeyman for the media, but one of the problems is that the people who are schizophrenic or have other degrees of mental illness can't tell the difference. And of course, according to our legal system, you can't convict someone of something they might do.
Let's see. Let's have somebody else first.
Hello, my name is Simon. I'm with the League of Greater Minds. I'm their teacher, in fact. So in regards to political rhetoric, I do have to strongly disagree on the statement that just because political rhetoric has been what it has been in the United States, it must continue to be. In fact, Sarah Palin, in justifying her blood libel comments, invoked the vice president shooting Alexander Hamilton in a duel. Now, that's not something we want to bring back. And as President Obama said, that can hardly be the example that we want to set for these children, okay, and these students. Secondly, on the issue of video games, taking a look at the audience, I will guess that most people here don't play these video games. But I will agree with our student in one thing. They are very realistic. And the fact that that a student, a young mind, an influential mind, can spend so many hours looking at the same exact situation, basically down the barrel of a gun, I believe has to have an impact on how they develop.
Well, and there is some evidence in terms of brain development that before hardwiring of the brain is actually completed, which doesn't happen until the early 20s, that there can be reshaping of thought processes and so on through constant repetitive exposure. So I think scientifically you're on very solid ground there. Yes, let's see. Yes, sir.
Well, I think it's another example of the press not being able to focus on what's important and always worrying about what's sensational. There's close to 4,000 teenage kids every year shot and killed in this country by other teenagers. There's very few incidents like we had the other day. Yet we spend days and weeks talking about this instead of how are we going to save the 4,000 kids? And that's education. And we know what to do in this country, but we don't have the will. And the media does not prioritize the conversation around smart, intelligent conversation that will teach and change the political will and show people that it is possible to educate any kid from anywhere for the money we spend now. And that is how we will save these children. So,
I think this gets back to this gentleman's point, which is there's the polarization and there's other dysfunction in our political system that is standing in the way of getting policy made, our representatives and our government officials doing their job to make things work more effectively. Let's see. I'm going to go to people who haven't spoken and then back to those who have. Yes, ma'am.
It's on? Yes? Is it on?
Yes.
Okay, now I can hear it. Okay. I just want to make two comments. One is that I agree with the gentleman or maybe a larger version of that is that I find it concerns me, the people that we're concerned about when they die and the people that we're not concerned about. And that, I think that has to do with power and privilege, and we all probably all know that, but it really disturbs me that there's a handful of people who are killed and we spend a great deal of time talking about it and there are children and adults dying every day. So due to violence, due to malnutrition, due to lack of education, whatever. But the other point I wanted to make is I just spent 2 years living in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is a state that loves its guns. they just passed a law to allow guns in bars. And I belong to the Graduate Student Senate there, and we had there was a new bill being pushed, which was to allow guns on campus as well as guns in bars. And so they wanted the Graduate Student Senate president wanted us to take a stand. It was sort of a token stand, but to take a stand. So I thought it was pretty obvious. I mean, I was in a room with a lot of really intelligent people that we would all take a stand on that. And I was in a room with a lot of people who grew up with guns. And they were really comfortable with guns. And they are not violent people. And, in fact, they felt like they were good people to have guns because they grew up with guns. They were comfortable. They were responsible gun owners. And it was the first time I've ever had that experience because I come from California, from Northern California. And so it was an interesting experience for me, and I feel like the gun issue was much more complicated than we realize. We're lumping in rifles for hunting in with semi-automatics or automatic guns. I mean, it's a complicated subject, and I think it's easy as a liberal to just say we need gun control, and I really don't think that people are going to go for that, and I'm not even sure it's true.
I understand that the similar measure has been pending in Pima County. Actually, the sheriff of Pima County has talked about that a little bit in Arizona, that that same type of legislation to permit guns on campus has been pending there. Well, maybe we could focus down a little bit then. If guns and mental illness are the largest part of this situation, then and if blanket, you know, controls on guns maybe are not what can happen here, there are some proposals that have been put on the table. So ban the 33-bullet ammunition clips for the Glock weapons like this fellow used. There are some proposals now, some of which are going to come to the floor of Congress, the administration is considering, for particular approaches. Then there's the question of, how, you know, what kind of background check do you do? Could you do something to ensure that those who are mentally ill and who could be violent can't have access to guns? So this young man, and then any others?
Thank you. As a consumer of the video games, I just think there's been a new discussion about how 3D is also affecting the potency of these games. And there's a very strong argument that's saying that this can really increase the effects of the realness of these games, especially on kids of my age. And so I think the comment that you made is an excellent point, because it's not the man who killed the representative or the senator wasn't most of the people of his age don't really play these video games. It's more teenagers, adolescents that are playing these games. And so I think there's a much higher effect of those than on these larger cases that we've been spending our time talking about. And also, with that point that you just made, the limitation of weapon use, there's a huge, because there's such a huge population of people in the U.S. that really like their guns, it's incredibly likely that if those regulations are applied, then people will just modify these weapons as they already have been to make them even further illegal.
That's a good point. You know, if there were a tightening of gun laws just so that the principles that have already been laid down in the U.S. for a waiting period for handguns, for registration of guns, were universally enforced, that might at least help somewhat. For instance, there's something in the U.S. Called the gun show exception to gun laws. And that is that those who buy and sell guns at gun shows don't have to apply the waiting periods and the licensing and the restrictions and so on. And there are other loopholes in the system that are actually giant loopholes that you can drive a truck through. So there may be things that can be done to just tighten things up so that the gun controls that we already have can be more universally enforced. Young man back there.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Stuart, and I'm also with the League of Creative Minds. And just a few things I would like to point out. While I cannot misinform you, because I honestly am not sure where the shooter got his gun from,
a sporting goods store.
So he'd got it from a sporting goods store. So I'm assuming that they asked him for a license and identification. They didn't. Oh, well.
I think identification, but there was nothing on his record at that point. That gets to his youth and the fact that he'd only recently been saying all these weird things in his classes and to people at the college he attended. But there was nothing in his background that immediately popped up.
One thing that I noticed when I was reading an article on this is that it said that he had attempted to enlist in the military. However, he'd been rejected due to the fact that he failed the psych exam.
And a drug test also.
And the drug test. So I feel like had that been available to the sporting goods store, they may have thought twice before selling him the gun. While I'm not really sure I could suggest any system to put in place to publicize this information, I would just like to comment that I kind of found that strange that while he failed both the psych and the drug exam, he was still able to walk into a sporting goods store and buy a gun.
A really good point. And, you know, in our society, we lean over backwards to protect people's privacy, the privacy of their medical records and so on. And sometimes I really wonder, do we lean too far in a case like this? So probably there were rules, you know, that the military wouldn't disclose that to other agencies and so on. Maybe that type of those type of boundaries need to be broken down, and that information does need to be shared, as you're implying, between different agencies. Okay. Let's see. Yes, ma'am. Just folks who haven't spoken yet. Oh, yes, sir.
Thanks again for hosting. This has been great. And I like the idea of being in a room of like-minded people. And by like-minded, I just mean that we're all very aware and interested in this issue because it's claiming the lives of people worldwide. You know, to come back to the mental health issue for a second, I would just end the gun issue now. I'm very comfortable just wrapping this around the perfect storm in the case of this gentleman. I think we do have an issue of mental health. I think there is an issue of access to guns. I think it's an issue here where, like several people have mentioned in the media and elsewhere, and rhetoric as well, the level of high-capacity weaponry that's out there and the access to it seems to be possibly the greater issue. That's kind of what you talked about with the legislation proposed by, I think it's Senator McCarthy in New York, where it's to go back to what it was prior to the assault weapons ban when it lapsed in 2004, I believe, which would have limited it to 10 bullets or whatever per I forget what they call those things.
Clip,
thank you. I mean, when you talk about the types of political assassinations that have happened in the past, someone mentioned earlier, you know, coming up with a methodology or a mindset around why you've committed this act. Loeffner seems to have had some personal gripe. He attended the event a year earlier, so he has that going for him. I mean, but it's the type of weapon. I mean, if he would have been able to go into that room with a weapon from 10, 15, 20 years ago that would have been banned currently, he wouldn't have been able to kill the number of people in the short period of time possible. So I'm in agreement that it probably is much more related to not only the access issue, but the type of guns that are out there now. So
right.
I'm strongly in favor of limiting the access to those types of weapons.
Yes, ma'am. Coming up, just a second.
There are so many unstable people and psychopaths out there who haven't done anything yet. There wouldn't be any reason for them to be on a no-gun list. And it seems to me that a family member or a school administrator or an employer should be able to put a person on a no-gun list. And they would have to get in a psychiatric evaluation in order to get one. It shouldn't be a big hardship for a normal person to not be able to get a gun for a while.
So some people here know this, but, you know, for full disclosure, my father was mentally ill and he shot himself in the head and killed himself. He had been 5150. He'd been under psychiatric care for many years. 5150 means taken away and held as a danger to himself and so on. He had a lot of guns. They were all taken away from him, and somehow he got a gun and shot himself. So I just say that, you know, you have to devise a system which somehow monitors this and enforces it. I mean, theoretically, he was banned from owning guns. He had threatened people with guns and so on. So and this was actually not that long ago. It was about 6 years ago. 7 years ago. So, yes, I agree, but then how do you prevent the person? So I think there's a lot of trafficking in guns that really doesn't fall into the, you know, the system that can be monitored. There's a lot that goes on sort of under the table. If somebody wants a gun, they can probably find a way to get a gun. The young lady behind you, and then Fred.
Hi, I'm Sarah from the League of Creative Minds, and I have to say I really agree with what you just said, and that I agree, and that there's a lot of underhand ways for you to get weapons, but you can stop a lot of these things from happening if you prevent people from getting these guns legally? Because I was just about to ask you, everyone here, if his parents should have been more aware of him and should they have taken the time to put him on a no-gun list or anyone, like a school administrator or something, because even though he was overage, I guess, but I feel like, was it maybe partly there? Could they have done something about this? I mean, even a lot of people get guns illegally, but if we could stop these things from happening legally, then, well, at least some of the problem would be solved.
You know, that's a very interesting point. In the media, anyway, remarkably little information about his parents has been found. I've kind of looked to see, because I always wonder when someone does something like that, what was the environment they came from? What was going on in their, you know, in the home they grew up in? And there's very little information about what was going on and what kind of people they were. So your point is really that if a family member is observing weird behavior and maybe even violent behavior, that they ought to bring it to the attention of, you know, they should do something about it. All right. So Fred's been waiting patiently here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up with guns, and I'm a graduate of the infantry school at Fort Benning and served as an infantry lieutenant in Korea, and I know how to use any kind of a gun that you can bring out. And I'm very well versed in how to use a gun. But I think that from the gun point of view, I think we should ban assault weapons and we should ban these multi-loading Glock-type weapons. Because if you're going to shoot game, you'd get lead poisoning if you ate what you shot. And so it's really not something you need to do. You don't need it for self-defense either. You know, if somebody came in my house and I had a gun, it would only take one bullet and they would be gone. So it's not something that people need all these weapons for that they
More
think
likely
they need.
You'd be gone based on.
I wouldn't use it. I prefer not to
data.
Use a gun. But my point is, but my concern is several fold. First of all, I have a very good friend. His son, grown son, is paranoid schizophrenic, like long years. His son was on his medication doing well. He got, because of the stigma, he.
You know, I hate to interrupt you, Fred. Somebody's having a medical emergency in the other room. Is there a doctor here? Could you go with George? Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Just be sure it isn't my wife.
There's another event going on in another room.
Anyway, I have this very good friend in Washington. They live in Arlington. His son is paranoid schizophrenic. He went off his medication, and he was having problems with his brain. Because if you're off your medication, or if you're on pot, which negates your medication, or drugs, which negates your medication, then you get into the situation that Longyear, whatever his name is.
Wafner.
Yeah. Anyway, and this young man got into his head, his delusions were such, that the reason he was having problems with his brain is because the CIA and the FBI were controlling his brain. So he went out and he got a Glock and some other weapons, and he got in the car, and he headed for the CIA. Well, his father got wind, and his father called, and they intercepted him. And you know what his father is most grateful for? He went to a federal prison instead of a state prison, because if he'd gone to a state prison, he'd gotten no treatment. In a federal prison, he got treatment. He was released with a mandate that he had to be in a supervised medication program, which has stabilized him to some extent. Now, when I talked to Willie Brown, the Commonwealth Club co-sponsored two conferences, one on mental health and public policy in 2002 and one on mental health and law in 2008, which I chaired, and we're working on another one coming up. One of the things that's happening in this country, now the governor of Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, her son is paranoid schizophrenic.
Okay, Fred, let's...
it short.
Yes, keep it short. We have lots of...
Anyway, he's an institution, but... because of her political persuasion, just like Gavin Newsom did here, they're eliminating the acute mental health care facilities. If these people aren't treated, there's brain damage, and ultimately they cannot be treated. So we have a vested interest, I think, in seeing that there's mental health treatment in our communities, because that protects us and our police and everybody else.
Okay, this gentleman, and then I'll come back over here.
Just one thing that I've been thinking about, because I agree with pretty much what everybody's saying, but the group that seems to represent the gun rights, the NRA, I don't know if I've ever met anybody that's an NRA member. And I would like to be in a room with some people that are maybe a little bit like your experience to see what they say about issues like this. And I feel like that sort of keeps us split apart. I realize tonight's not the night to discuss that. But that's something I would like to see happen because I have no idea. And I can't believe they're out to kill people.
Right. Whatever their feelings are. So we did last year here in San Francisco and over in Lafayette, we had two forums on the open carry of handguns, because this was sort of the latest liberalization of gun laws, trying, you know, where the NRA and other groups have been arguing that carrying unloaded weapons, handguns, legally, if you have a permit, should not be restricted. And there are certain counties and cities in the Bay Area where that is legal. So we had a big debate about that. I do know, actually, a lot of people who are in the NRA and so on. And what I think gets confused is there is the issue of the constitutional rights, the Second Amendment. And by the way, one person who couldn't be here tonight sent me an email and recited the phrase from the Second Amendment, which is that there should be a well-regulated militia where citizens have the right to bear arms. And she wanted us to discuss the well-regulated aspect of that because it's not a blanket right. It is has to be well-regulated. So what constitutes well-regulated? So the issue really is, I think there's sometimes a confusion between those constitutional rights and other agendas. Other agendas are, you know, the wish to hunt, the wish to defend your home, the feeling that, you know, if only the bad guys have guns, then good people won't be able to defend themselves. And to be very frank, gun manufacturing and sales is a big business in the United States. So there may be some mingling of agendas here, which goes under the banner of the Second Amendment, but there's all kinds of other things going on that really don't have anything to do with the actual realistic need for the citizenry to protect itself through hunting rifles and automatic weapons and handguns against a tyrannical government. You know, these days, I have to actually laugh a little bit. When you look at what's one of the worst threats that has arisen in the world, well, it's probably Iran's nuclear program. So Israeli computer scientists have figured out a way to deal with that that has nothing to do with guns and shooting. It has to do with hacking into the computing systems at the uranium enrichment facilities in Israel. So are handguns and rifles really the best way for the American citizenry to protect itself against a possibly abusive government? There may be all kinds of other ways in a modern world for us to... WikiLeaks or whatever, you know, hacking into... Let's say we did have an abusive, tyrannical government, well, it would have to use computer systems, and there are probably a lot of people who would know some strategies for dealing with that. So it's a little bit of an antique idea. So anyway, I just think there are all these, there's a mixture of agendas here. The constitutional one, because it has to do with freedom and liberty and protection of our rights, is the one that's used as the umbrella, but it may not really be the most, you know, applicable one. Okay, yes, ma'am.
My name is Katie, and I'm from the League of Creative Minds. But what I feel about this is that there's a lot of people that like their guns but don't know how to use their guns. And for me, I've grown up around guns my whole life. My dad has a hunting club, and he's very well-versed on how to use the gun, and he's taught me and stuff. And I think that growing up around that, it kind of makes me assume that people that own guns know how to use them. But I think that that's not a true assumption, and I think that being able to regulate how, you know, the people who acquire the guns know how to use the guns is something really important, because there's so many people out there that have these, you know, dangerous weapons that don't know how to use them. So I think that that's something right. That needs to be addressed.
There are supposedly requirements before you buy a handgun that you go through a gun safety, you know. Yeah. Well, I have the feeling, I mean, did Mr., you know, Loeffner go through a gun safety training? I don't think so. So you have, because your family is familiar with this, but probably most people who get a gun, and certainly with some kind of emotional, wish to do something with that gun are not going to go through those gun safety courses. The young man in the back has been very patient.
So I'd like to address a number of things. The first is, well, a while ago, not too recently, but recent enough, a man in China walked into a classroom and killed a number of students, not with a gun, but with a meat cleaver. So just keeping a gun out of someone's hand won't stop them from hurting themselves or others. They'll find ways to murder someone or even commit suicide without a gun. Michelle Giffords, the senator, she would meet people in the parking lot of a supermarket. So it would have been really relatively easy for this man to walk up with perhaps a knife and stab her. If someone corners you with a blade, unless you're a black belt in Aikido or something, odds are you're going to come away maimed or very heavily wounded. And I forgot the rest of what I was going to say.
But that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Okay, Jackie?
I'm Jackie Jacoberger, and there's so many of these issues all mixed up here. First of all, I've worked for so many years on civil discourse, and that's really important to me. I don't think it's the principal issue here. I think what we kind of forget is the civil liberties aspect, because it has to do with mental illness. I can remember when people could be involuntarily put into institutions, and they didn't have to prove that they were actually a threat to someone. I mean, now it's very hard to commit someone, and I think parents run into that situation. So, but I found it interesting that Time magazine showed a picture of a little altar thing in his backyard, and I thought, if he was living in my house, I would have known that. But so I think you have to be aware, but having had a daughter who had a schizophrenic boyfriend who went off his medication and he became violent with her, and all she could do was get a restraining order against him, and I don't know what his parents did. So we have that issue of the, we can't infringe on somebody's liberties.
Right.
But the gun control, I don't think anybody... I'm glad you made the point about the well-regulated militia, because I had that in my head. But nobody needs a 30-round clip, as somebody's already said here. I just think that we have to regulate the gun. Now, my understanding from Time magazine's article was that he actually passed the drug test, but he told the recruiter that he had been smoking a good deal of pot before, but that he actually had been off of it long enough to pass the drug test when he went to the recruiter.
I see.
So that's another issue. So I don't know how you put them on a list.
Right. So let's see. Lots of folks here. Okay. Let's go to this gentleman here. Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Well, why don't we just, again, people who haven't spoken, and then we'll get back to the people who have.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Baggus, and several of you have mentioned about the well-regulated issue, the well-regulated militia. In the summer of 1965, my National Guard unit was assigned to Watts, and my platoon was put out near 137th and Avalon, if I remember rightly. We had a second lieutenant.
And these young folks probably don't know what happened in Watts in 1965.
It was
a riot.
Do you
want to say a word about that?
National Guard was called out.
This is in Los Angeles, inside the U.S.
And we were about midnight. And as I say, this really speaks to the question of a well-regulated militia, because we had a second lieutenant. And we were at one point down this alley. There was some broken glass sounding. And second lieutenant says, got us attention, and then issued, we're going to stop this right now. And he gave out two or three commands, and he finally said, okay, at my command, fire. And here was a platoon of 15 or more men, all with submachine guns. And we were blind fire down into an alley. This was incredible. And we didn't know what to do, and we looked around, and of course the lieutenant was right out in front. And we looked at each other, and there was one guy, he was kind of a senior guy in the unit, and he took his gun and pointed up in the air off to the side. And we all fired off to the side. It was just one of those things. It was insane. But we were a well-regulated militia. Mm-hmm. And it brings up the issue of training and training and training. If you're going to have a gun, I don't care whether it's a handgun, whatever, you must be trained in it. And there's got to be some sort of regulation
right. That
requires that. I don't know how you folks feel about that, but...
Okay, let's see. This young man in the red shirt hasn't spoken yet.
Hello, I'm Kel, and I'm with the League of Creative Minds. I really just wanted to add on to the point that the media, really the stories that they want to put out there is what sells. They're not there to teach us all what it is. It's not a government-run organization. Sure, they have a reputation to uphold, but... if they're giving out the stories that everybody wants to watch, that also means their ads are going to be watched, and they want the most revenue as they can, so they're going to say the most selling story, and the most selling story is going to be a terrible tragedy like this one, played multiple times with interviews with people who weren't that involved and things like that, rather than giving a long segment about this and then segments about every other terrible tragedy, which might happen on a smaller scale. And then also, on the video games point, I mean, before it used to be two paddles hitting a tiny little white square, and it's only going to get more realistic, it's only going to get worse, and there should probably be some form of regulation for that too. And with guns, buying and selling them, we do need regulation, but with the gun sales, it's a pretty high amount that people who have gotten illegal, who have done crimes with guns, have gotten them from a gun show or from the black market. So making them harder to get for people who shouldn't have these guns is a good thing, but it's going to be hard to regulate for them to not have them at all.
I think any of you who are interested should do some research on how the gun manufacturing and sales business works in the U.S., because it's pretty interesting if you look into it. The way the money from the gun sellers finds its way into the political system. So why don't we have restrictions on automatic weapons? Why did the automatic weapon ban get rolled back in 2004 and so on? There's a whole system here where not just the NRA, but other organizations contribute to political candidates. And it's big contributions, and they also contribute to wildlife foundations and other groups that are in the states of the representatives, so in Wyoming and Montana and Colorado and so on and so on. There are all kinds of other organizations that are actually 501c3 organizations, nonprofits, that are tied into the NRA and gun lobby and so on. And so if you see the amount of money, and it kind of then it goes back to the gun manufacturers who are profiting from this, if you see how all that money finds its way into the U.S. Congress and the state legislatures, you'll see some of the reasons that nothing has been done about this, or very little has been done. It's all about the money. So just you can look into this on the Internet and so on and just see who gets the contributions and how it works. Okay, the gentleman in the back.
Thank you very much for hosting this debate. I gather we're running out of time.
Close, yes.
I just wanted to appreciate so much your bringing up this part of the amendment about the well-regulated militia. I think we're all resonating with that. And I just want to say the background principle of that is that in a society, civic principles and peace principles have to be applied in balance and proportion. And no one principle, such as fairness, for instance, should be annihilated by another principle such as freedom of speech. You can't allow freedom of speech to annihilate fairness, which translates into one person, one vote, incidentally, and therefore totally changes the debate about, you know, the skewing by big money of elections.
Right.
So that's a bigger issue. And then I did want to say, because you said, well, if guns and mental illness are the largest part of this issue, I really want to say that I believe that violence and nonviolence is the big choice. And even behind that is goodwill versus ill will. In other words, the desire to build up, to preserve, to cherish, to find a good fit, which is actually the definition of that word, good, to fit well together, fitting, mm-hmm. And ill will, the desire to harm mm-hmm. as a solution. Mm-hmm. We all have a little bit of rage that comes up from time to time, but we can choose to cherish and come back to goodwill.
Right. I think that's true. At the same time, if we're dealing with folks who are mentally ill and violent, they aren't. I don't believe they're people of ill will or goodwill. They're people of mental impairment. And I think that's sometimes not very well understood in our society. We often impute volition to people, that they're doing this for one reason or another, or whether it's a political reason or something else. It's not. It's just irrationality. They're not able to think things through in a rational way. So, in fact, Jackie, there was a restraining order against your daughter's mentally ill boyfriend. Well, a restraining order may or may not work because the person would have to be rational to make the calculation that if I violate this restraining order, something bad is going to happen to me. And a lot of people who are mentally ill are not able to make that calculation. That's what mental illness is. And so I think we need a much better understanding in our society of what mental illness is. And you have to deal with it in a more paternalistic way, frankly, than just, you know, simply saying there's goodwill and ill will. There are people who can't make those choices for themselves. So we have to deal with them in a way that gets them care and treatment and so on, but protects people from them if they become violent. And, you know, it's done with an understanding of the illness that's involved. Okay, we have, yes, young man in the green shirt.
So first, I'm Nicholas from the League of Creative Minds.
What grade are you in?
I'm in sixth grade.
All right.
I'd like to acknowledge what Cal said, and is that guns need to be regulated. However, this brings up an interesting point, which is that if you regulate pistols and small handguns, it's very easy for someone without a gun license to go to a gun show and buy a gun that is 50 times more dangerous than these pistols. And that is what will happen if these handguns are regulated so much, is these people will end up getting guns 50 times more powerful.
I totally agree with you. And by the way, we are going to have to end in just a few minutes, but I want to point out what the young man in the gray shirt here said. This issue of just, because this is a huge topic, and especially with the lobbying involved and the mental illness questions, it's hard to try to figure out how to tackle it, how to do anything about this. I thought your idea was really interesting. There are people who actually have come in contact with some part of the system that has identified them as having a problem, having, you know, potential drug problem, behavioral problems, and so on. And the fact that that information doesn't get from one agency, like you pointed out, the military, to the sporting goods stores that are selling guns, that's something that I think citizens could do something about, try to help create a registry or get the information better to where it needs to go. That's something that's like a small bite that people might be able to work on and, you know, using the power of information technology that is accessible to pretty much all of us now, try to help with that aspect of the problem. Okay, just time for maybe a couple more comments. So let's see, this lady back here has not had a chance yet.
Well, commenting on that point, in Mexico you actually need a permit from the army to have a gun, so that's very, very regulated. But linking this to Mexico, the New York Times just released an article in which it pointed that 90% of the guns used by drug lords in Mexico, they come from here, especially from Houston. So legislators from states where population actually supports guns should have this in mind and link to their supports.
You're absolutely right, and particularly the border states are the source. Texas, Arizona are a source of guns that are flowing over into Mexico. And the ATF, I know, is monitoring this. It's one of the big agenda items for our agencies that watch guns. One of their number one directives right now is to try to prevent the flow of so many guns, and particularly, again, under the table, through the gun shows, all of this stuff, into Mexico, into the hands of the drug lords. Okay. We appreciate the teacher bringing his folks, his people here tonight. So this will be the last word.
I actually did want to comment on the issue of Mexico and Latin America as a whole. I'm also an immigrant to this country. I'm from Venezuela, which is an extremely violent place, even though we have a highly regulated firearm legislation. And so, indeed, Mexico is seeing 3,000 deaths a year, which is, of course, far more than we see in the United States, mostly due to the accessibility of these weapons. I don't know if anybody saw the statements made by Vicente Fox, ex-president of Mexico, very recently. He said, let's legalize all drugs. Now, Vicente Fox is not crazy. He's not a neo-hippie. He's not anything like that. But he does realize that there is a sort of legal market for these firearms to make their way south. And he is now trying to legalize the drugs that are making their way north. And this does affect us here. I mean, go to Bryant Street. Go to the courts. You will see that a third of the people that are being tried do have mental health issues, and the rest are involved in drug issues. So these are issues that are intimately related, okay? And finally, as an immigrant, I do have to say the U.S. has a tremendous responsibility in this issue. People are suffering greatly south of the border because of the amount of guns which are available. Every weekend in my hometown of Caracas, Venezuela, we have 40 violent deaths just from firearms, not even car accidents or anything. Now, that has affected every single family in the country. Imagine if everybody who you know has lost somebody due to a firearm. Most of these firearms are proven to come from the United States. It's an unfortunate situation, but as a world superpower, there is a responsibility of the citizens of this country to take hold of this issue and just take responsibility. Thanks.
I want to thank everyone for coming tonight and participating in this discussion. And in one way or another, on the club's blog, future programs, we will get back to this issue, all aspects of it, the guns, the mental illness, and, of course, what we do every day is try to have a civil discussion about political issues and economic issues and so on. The Commonwealth Club's blog is commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. And I don't know where we're going to post this program. We probably post the audio or video somewhere. You can go to our website and find out. So once again, thank you so much. And particularly thank you to you young folks who are so interested in this and putting your creative minds at work on these problems. Good luck in, you know, helping to solve these. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you, everybody.